Thanks for listening to The Rest Is Politics. Sign up to The Rest Is Politics Plus to enjoy ad-free listening, receive a weekly newsletter, join our members' chat room, and gain early access to live show tickets. Just go to therestispolitics.com. That's therestispolitics.com.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Welcome to The Rest Is Politics with me, Alistair Campbell.
And me, Rory Stewart.
And Rory, what a weekend. We had the whole drama, would he, wouldn't he resign, Humza Yousef, and he has. Would he, wouldn't resign, Sanchez in Spain, and he hasn't. And we had this defection from Dan Poulter, from Tory to Labour. So we'll cover all that. Mainly, I think, Scotland for us is probably the most interesting of the three. And then I think we're going to devote the whole of the second half to a discussion on the politics of defence, how defence and security spending is becoming, rightly in our view, but it's very, very interesting how it's going to play out politically, a massive political issue, not just here, but right around the world. So let's start with Humza. If people who want to get a sense of him, the man, the personality, the life and times, we interviewed him a few months ago on Leading. Both found him very personable, very pleasant. Both had doubts, maybe, about his overall political skills, I think. And this does seem to have been a catastrophic miscalculation.
So to do a quick explainer on what's happened. So the SNP, the Scottish National Party, had their last election in Scotland in 2021 for the Scottish Parliament. And they came in and they did not have an overall majority. They're very close, but they didn't have an overall majority. So Nicola Sturgeon, who was then the party leader, entered into an agreement called the Bute House Agreement, where she went into coalition with the Greens. And the Greens came into government with them, given some ministerial positions. And in return, the SNP endorsed some Green Party positions. And this was the way that Scotland was run. Until, over the last few weeks, some tensions emerged between the SNP and the Greens. And one of the big tensions was around the fact that Scotland, having signed up to quite ambitious climate targets, and this is a theme, actually, we're seeing in a lot of European politics we've talked about, turned out that it wasn't meeting them. This is a big theme because, of course, if you wanted to be unfair, you could probably make the same criticism about the Mayor of London, that it's tempting for devolved governments to sign up to very ambitious climate targets, but they don't have all the levers to control how they're actually delivered. And in this case, the Climate Change Committee said you're well off target, and the Scottish government had to announce that it wasn't going to meet its targets. The Greens then started signalling recently that they were very uncomfortable with this and that they were going to go through a 4 or 5 week period where they were going to go back to party members and decide whether they were going to stay part of this government. At which point, Humza Yousef made the very unusual decision of summoning the Green ministers in to see him in his residence.
Bute House.
And basically briefing to the press that they were fired and making them do the walk of shame out the door without their ministerial cars, at which point he appears to have woken up and found himself without a majority. And there are times looking at this where one sort of slightly wonders whether he can count, whether he, what he was really thinking he was doing here.
Well, Roy, this may be a good opportunity to plug our next Leading. We've done Ehud Olmert, former Israeli Prime Minister, this week. Next week is Nancy Pelosi, the legendary veteran majority leader and speaker of the Democrat Party in Congress. And one of her the thing she said to us, and that she says many, many times, first rule of politics, you have to know how to count. And having upset the Greens in the way that he did, and it was really humiliating. I mean, I'm sure they're a complete pain in the neck at times within a coalition. Any minority party tends to be annoying because they can, you know, the tail can wag the dog. But they get summoned in, utter humiliation, phoned at 7:30, be here at 8:00, you know, we'll give you a cup of coffee and some stale croissants. Tells them they're no longer wanted and off they go. Now, you'd think of something so big and dramatic that he'd have then lined up what was going to follow. But the only person who, you know, it's obvious the Tories wouldn't support him, pretty obvious Labour wouldn't support him because they're on the, you know, they've got real momentum in Scotland at the moment. The only person and party on which he could have possibly relied to close that gap and get some kind of, you know, sensible governing arrangement was Ash Regan, who was a contender in the leadership election that Humza Yousaf won, who then defected to Alex Salmond's party, ALBA. And when she defected, Humza Yousaf's line on her, well, she's no great loss. So that was not going to be a great one to start. Alex Salmond, meanwhile, is out of the traps doing what Alex Salmond loves to do, which is one, be the center of attention, two, appear as the man of reason and calm, who's saying, I'm sure we can come to some sort of arrangement, but he needs to get rid of all these sort of, you know, conservative, anti-independence people who are sort of running the show. And of course, he finds over the weekend that he can't.
To add to the humiliation, he decided to write a letter to the Conservatives and Labour, effectively asking them whether they would be prepared to support his government, which seems, again, a really bizarre, slightly naive bit of misjudgment. There's absolutely no way that these opposition parties that are going for him were going to sign up and prop up his government. There's a bit of a mystery before we get to the end of this. I just want to see if you can make the generous case for Humza Yousaf. And I've been speaking to a lot of people about this over the weekend, speaking to Ruth Davidson, for example, who was the Conservative leader in Scotland, who's really good on this stuff. And she's obviously very fond of Humza Yousaf. And I don't want to, you know, overly quote her on all this stuff. But there's a suggestion that people think he hadn't really thought it through. It can't quite be that bad, can it? I mean, however, you know, distracted a leader is, the one thing you would have thought obviously he should be concentrating on is how on earth does he keep his majority together? And the only explanation of what he did with the Greens is that he must, I suppose, have calculated that they were 100% definitely going to leave him. And therefore, rather than getting dumped, he was going to show his strength by dumping them before they dumped him.
Well, the talk is, as they say, that there were a number of people, including Stephen Flynn, the SNP leader in Westminster, who persuaded him that he had to show real strength. And the only way to show real strength in this moment was, whilst the Greens are saying we're going to take several weeks to decide whether we're going to pull the plug or not, was actually to say, no, excuse me, you are the tail, I am the dog, I'm the big guy, you're the little guys, I will push you around. So I think Stephen Flynn's stock has fallen considerably with some of his colleagues. You get the feeling that a lot of this was about emotion, which in politics it often is. Because I thought I'd get some of the Scottish media this morning, I was reading Tom Gordon in the Herald, and this is, it starts with the word the SNP, but actually I think you could delete the SNP for the UK and put in the Conservatives. It says, SNP now showing classic hallmarks of government in terminal decline, struggling leader, powerful rebels, bitter knife edge votes, legislative turmoil, electoral reverses looming, opposition parties chorusing, time for a change, after years and years in power. And it does sort of feel that, we said this, didn't we? We said this to Humza Yousaf, that, you know, you'd had these two incredible dominant figures, Alex Salmond, so his leadership ended in turmoil, Nicola Sturgeon, her leadership's ended in turmoil, and he comes along, and the turmoil can't just keep going on indefinitely. So all these people who are now possibly throwing their hat into the ring, they probably, a little bit like the Penny Mordaunts and that lot, are doing it as a sort of last desperate gasp at trying to salvage something before the next election.
Yeah. I talked also to Luke Graham, who was a Conservative MP for South Perthshire and the Ockles in Scotland. And he was also interesting. I mean, obviously, this isn't a kind of masterclass on political strategy, but I think a lot of us would have thought that it was at least worth the gamble to wait 4 or 5 weeks for the Greens and see if you couldn't win them back somehow, whether there wasn't some kind of rhetoric. Because he pointed out that the Green leadership were actually making some quite warm noises towards Humza Yousaf.
Well, the thing that my friends who are sort of, you know, who think that we're sort of dirty climate denying weaselings, even though we think we're not on the climate, the real environmentalists, they actually think that the Greens have not been very good on the environment because they're far too committed to nationalism. It's like nationalism has become their big thing. So I think it should have been possible. Look, I don't know how the personal relationships go between him and the co-leaders of the Greens, but it does seem to me that they were very clear the minute they walked out the door. Well, that's it. Once you've broken trust on a scale like that, we're not having it. But what it means now, so the last leadership election took 6 weeks, I think it was. They reckon they can do this one in 4. The last leadership election really was about everybody throwing everything at Kate Forbes to stop her. and Hamza Yousaf emerged and he won with a lot of establishment backing within the party. She, I imagine, will stand again. There's talk now of John Swinney, he's had all sorts of jobs. Very nice guy, very personable, very experienced, but very associated clearly with his predecessors or with the previous leaders.
The sort of old guard, seen as too much of an establishment figure, yeah.
Yeah, and then there's Jenny Gilruth, who is... you couldn't make this up, who's the education minister, and she's the partner of Kezia Dugdale, who used to be the leader of the Scottish Labour Party, and then Neil Gray, the health guy. Now, I don't know what's going to happen, but I wonder if Kate Forbes actually might emerge. But the trouble there is she has terrible relations with the Greens because of some of her views. And the truth is, the Greens, this may be an election for all of the members, but actually the six MSPs who are Green, the seventh is the presiding officers, it doesn't have a vote, I imagine, when it gets to Parliament coming back. But they are the electorate in many ways now, because what's going to have to happen is you're going to have to get a sense of, well, who can actually put this show on the road by coming to some sort of arrangement with the Greens? And that, I think, is quite difficult for Kate Forbes.
Kate Forbes is interesting, isn't it? Because the story seems to be that she has quite a lot of support amongst members of the SNP, but it's very unpopular with the MPs, partly because she's got this fascinating background that we talked about when the leadership election was going on, which is that her parents were missionaries from the Free Church of Scotland. Mm. So she lived in India, went to school in the Himalayas, then went to Oxford. But the Free Church of Scotland, you know, rejects same-sex marriage as opposed to most abortions, opposed to sex outside marriage. So I think, am I right in saying that she took quite a strong position on the transgender issue, which was quite a big defining issue within the SNP at the time?
Yeah, but what was quite interesting yesterday, when I was on the Trevor Phillips program and Alex Salmond was on, and he was actually... saying that people now want a leader of Scotland who is, he didn't use these words, but isn't obsessing about the sort of, you know, gender ideology issues as opposed to things that people really, really care about. So I guess the point I'm making is, will all that stuff that did her so much damage in the last leadership election, will it do the same damage this time? I just don't know. They're in a real mess. And I think there is something in the point that Tom Gordon was making about the SNP. I think there is something in that about them and the Tories now. They just both seem like they've been around too long. They haven't delivered. The soap opera is just becoming tedious. And that does all play into time for a change. And frankly, Keir Starmer being a very lucky general.
And there's unlikely, though, to be an election. I believe, you know, they get a chance now, 20-odd days, to choose their next first minister. There'd need to be a two-thirds majority, I think, to trigger an election. I guess the Conservatives they're in the problem that the Lib Dems were in the British Parliament in 2019,
they
don't want an election. But of course, they can't quite say they don't want an election, which is where the Lib Dems were in 2019. So I guess they might feel forced to vote for it, but they probably wouldn't get that. They definitely wouldn't get the two-thirds. So you're likely to end up with a more, as you say, like the Tories and Rishi Sunak, that the SNP stumbles on.
Yeah.
With a new leader.
And of course, don't forget that there have been minority government. I mean, the whole system that we devised for the Scottish Parliament was, the electoral system was designed so as that no one party would ever have total power, so that you have had these minority governments before. But I think that they're so dependent on relationships. And when those relationships break down, it becomes very, very, very difficult. And of course, don't forget, in the background, you've still got the whole Nicola Sturgeon, her husband being charged, and all this sort of stuff. So it's a real mess for the SNP right now.
Just quickly to wrap that up, I mean, Ruth Davidson refers to how strange and traumatic this is, because Nicola Sturgeon, particularly during COVID, played this mother of the nation role. And it's been very destabilizing to a lot of people to see these legal cases come against her husband and against the treasurer. Probably won't be cases against her, because it may be sufficiently distanced from her, the question of the finances, the party, which is what's causing all these criminal charges.
Can we just come very briefly just south of the border? Do you know who Steve Cram is, Rory?
Vaguely. Come on.
God's sake. Sebastian Coe, you know, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, we've interviewed him. Yeah. Steve Ovett, do you remember Steve Ovett?
Yeah, I remember Steve Ovett, yeah.
Okay, well, Steve Cram was the third unbelievably brilliant middle distance runner in the UK at that time, okay?
Gotcha.
And he's got a bone to pick with you.
Well, he's got a lot of bones, given that I'm struggling to remember his name, yeah.
He sent me a message saying, Rory keeps saying that independence, we need more independence. And he says that Kim McGuinness, who's running to be North East Mayor, is the best mayor that the Northeast could have, and she's being put at risk by the independent Jamie Driscoll. Independents, tell Rory, are not always a good idea. How about that?
Well, I guess this is what a lot of people do to you. If you try to run as an independent, well, of course, we should at some point, yeah, get on to this question of RFK and American politics.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But that's, of course, what, you know, I got very aggressive messages from the Conservatives, obviously in the London mayoral race, because what they always accuse you of doing is splitting the vote. If you have the temerity to run against one of the big parties as an independent, that's the way they always try to show you up.
Well, Steve and I are backing Kim. Now, Sanchez, Mr. Sanchez, he...
And this is the Prime Minister of Spain, for those of us who are not absolutely on the fingers, fingers on the pulse.
And so he spent the weekend agonising. He did this extraordinary thing where he basically, his wife was being attacked over alleged corruption and influence peddling. You know, and to be fair to him, some of this is coming from the hard right. It's a think tank that got the thing off the ground, headed by a guy who's very close to the hard right. But anyway, he then sort of said publicly he's going to take a few days to decide whether he can actually bear carrying on.
Which, again, is very bizarre, because presumably you would never recommend that to a politician, because it does sound a little bit as though you're about to, it sounds like you're in real trouble. It doesn't seem like a great statement of strength, does it, to say, I'm going to take 5 days off and I'm thinking of stepping down. It's not normally what you recommend. It's not what you want a general to do on the eve of battle, is it really?
No, that's true. But I think there is something a bit different about Spanish politics. Our friend Miriam González Durantes, we keep plugging our previous leading interviews, but there's another one. She makes the point, she had a very good piece in the FT, that there are no rules governing all this stuff in Spain. They don't have these sort of ethics advisors and codes of conduct and so forth. So he just thinks this is people getting at his wife. I wonder whether the wife, I mean, look, you know as well as I do that wives and partners and they're very, very important in politics. And, you know, I just wonder whether the wife maybe said, look, I'm not putting up with this. So gave him an ultimatum. You sort of stand up for me 100% or I'm just pulling the plug. So who knows whether there was kind of something of that nature going on as well. Look, I don't know, but I think it might have strengthened him a bit.
I don't think so. I mean, I think you could make the case that Spanish politics is so polarized anyway, it's not going to change anyone's view. But no, I think it does not.
And he's part of the polarization, by the way. He's quite a polarizing figure himself.
Partly because he's cobbled together a coalition by offering amnesties to Catalan nationalists, which has really offended a lot of Spanish people who feel that he's actually flouted the law and encouraged separatism and stuff. But no, I can't think it remotely works. I think it will be exploited by his political opponents. Nobody wants to sense that their leader is having second thoughts about the job. I mean, we can get onto this because Scott Morrison's rather interestingly in Australia, I think you've put me in touch with this, has been talking much more frankly about some of his depression when he was in office. But and there is a theme that we're seeing around the world, which Humza Yousaf is part of, and Leo Varadkar. I mean, you know, we can make a case that our leading interviews, the kind of kiss of death for politicians, that
can we get Rishi Sunak on, please?
Exactly, that's right. But there is a sense in which politicians seem to be more liable to step down and resign before they need to than would have been the case in the past. And I think that's partly to do with the fact that, for a lot of reasons, politics is becoming a really unpleasant business. I think it's why we lost Sanna Marin in Finland. I think that's why we lost Jacinta Ardern and why we're going to have an incredible number of Conservative and actually quite a lot of Labour MPs leaving at this election.
Look, over 10,000 people turned out to a demonstration in Madrid at the weekend, basically saying don't go. Now, I can't imagine if Rishi Sunak or any of his predecessors...
Or Humza Yousaf.
Yeah, if they just sort of said, I'm thinking about going over the weekend, I can't imagine that 10,000 people would turn out in the streets and say, oh no, please don't go. The people would get on with their lives. I think that what would maybe disappoint some people is I think what he could have done and should have done is rather than sort of poor me, my wife's being attacked, which is, you know, I've had a bit of this. It's very, very unpleasant when that kind of stuff happens. But what I think he could have done is come out and said, look, you know, the problem with this stuff is there are no rules. There is no process. So actually, as the investigation goes on into my wife, what I am going to do is set up the means by which, in any future case, these relationships between spouses and ministers and contractors and so forth, we're going to have to put properly rules in place. And I think that he would definitely have got strength out of that.
It's an interesting one because the ethics advisors in Britain, I think, have been talking about this in one of the latest reports. I think I saw a bit of this in the Grieve report that we discussed on the show, which is how do you put the rules around spouses? Because on the one hand, you want to say spouses, you know, the husband or the wife of a politician can have their own lives, have their own careers. They shouldn't be, you know, we shouldn't be in a world in which people have to give up their careers. On the other hand, if they're in business, there are real dangers of conflict of interest. And traditionally, I mean, in Indonesia, Suharto's wife was the channel for almost all the corruption for 32 years. Imelda Marcos, the Philippines, again, the channel for an enormous amount of the corruption.
And lots of shoes.
Same with Chiang Kai-shek's wife. So I think it's a really tricky issue there. And but you're right. We need Spain desperately needs some rules.
But you know, I actually do think that Rishi Sunak is not to blame, and nor is his wife for the phenomenal wealth that she enjoys. But I do think there have been stories around about companies that she's invested in, that she's associated with, that have done pretty well out of government contracting, which, again, I think you have to be very, very careful, particularly at that level.
Yeah. I mean, I think to defend her, I think when people looked into those stories, it's much more that she's got these enormous assets. She's worth hundreds of millions and she's invested in an incredible number of companies. I don't think people are suggesting that she's been tilting or conflict of interest.
I think when you're talking about the prime minister, I do think there has to be some sort of arm's length. I agree with what you said. It's like when Tony became prime minister, every case that Cherie did, the media were there sort of covering it as though it was her case, as it were. It was about her, which is just utterly absurd, and it made it very, very difficult. And Miriam Gonzalez Durantes, of course, married to Nick Clegg, she got all sorts of grief from our media. She's one of the few people who hates the Daily Mail and Paul Dacre almost as much as I do. But I think that when you get to a certain level, I think you've got to be particularly careful.
There's one example of this, isn't there? We've talked about this a little bit, which is Paul Pelosi, married to the former Speaker Emerita, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, who has made an incredible fortune, nearly, you know, well over $100 million, a lot of them off doing things like selling Google stocks before information became public, which was already known to Congress, which is apparently legal in the US system, but looks pretty peculiar from the outside.
It's back to rules. So that's Sanchez, he's staying, and let's see how that plays out. Briefly, Dan Poulter, the defection.
Yeah, so he came into Parliament with me, 2010, Conservative MP, one of, I think, three GPs who came in my intake, all of whom left the Conservative Party. So they were Sarah Wollison, Philip Lee, and Dan Poulter were the three GPs who came in with me. I think it was Sarah who went off the Lib Dems, Philip who went off the Lib Dems, and now Dan Poulter who's gone off to Labour.
And you who've become a passionate supporter of Susan Hall, the mayoral candidate.
Exactly. Me who started voting for Count Binface. But I'm not a GP. I'm not a doctor.
He is not voting. Count Binface, I'm talking to you directly now. He is not voting for you. Do not put that on your leaflets.
So there's been a lot of rumours as people get more and more unhappy towards the end of their time in Parliament. They begin thinking, well, I'm going to step down, I'm going to get a job. And some people start thinking, actually, I'm unhappy with this government and maybe I'm more comfortable with the Labour government and I'm going to think about defecting over to Labour. And Alistair, you had a couple of examples. You had a guy called Quentin Davis, but then you had, I think the first one was Alan Howarth, is that right?
Mm. Well, actually, Quentin Davis was after my time. That was when Gordon was Prime Minister.
Right.
The two that I was involved in were Alan Howarth and Sean Woodward.
Right.
And Alan Howarth, I've got to say, it was one of the most enjoyable operations in which I was ever involved.
Talk us through. So this guy is like a classic looking Tory MP.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then somebody comes and tells you he's unhappy.
It was Margaret Hodge. Margaret Hodge said, look, she didn't say he's talking about defecting. She said, I think he's really, really unhappy. He's really uncomfortable. And then I said, well, look, just keep talking to him and, you know, let's see where it goes. And then eventually he met Tony. He met, I think, actually, I can remember telling John Prescott, because John Prescott, who's even more tribal than I am, Rory, the idea of defection is just horrible to people like John Prescott. How can you possibly want to defect?
So he looks a bit at him as old stuffy generals used to look at traitors coming over to give them information on the other side. Yeah,
and there's always a bit of that. There's always a bit of that because, of course, if you defect one way, there's always this suspicion that you could defect.
And Howarth was an amazing thing, wasn't he? I just remembered that he was a member of the Thatcherite kind of wing of the party.
Yeah.
And he was the first Conservative MP to defect directly from the Conservatives to Labour ever.
yeah.
And the first former Conservative MP to sit as a Labour MP since Oswald Mosley.
Forgetting the Mosley connection, that was why it was so enjoyable. And listen, Roy, I'm up in the top of my house here.
Right.
And when we finally got him, as it were, over the line, and a little bit as you suggested earlier, you obviously want to do this at the maximum point of impact.
Right.
So what I did was, we didn't have to wait that long, but I said, look, I would like to do this on the eve of the Conservative Party conference.
How very helpful of you.
Yeah. Exactly. And what I'd like to do, as I'd like to do it as an exclusive in The Observer with Tony Bevins, and God, I wish Tony Bevins was still alive, because he would absolutely be destroying this government week after week after week. And then David Frost on Sunday in the morning. So very, very similar to what happened this weekend. They did an article in The Observer, and then Dan Poulter was on a pre-record on Laura Koonsberg. I think I'm right, Alan Howarth did a live with David Frost. And I can remember phoning David Frost, and I think on the Friday, I said, David, who have you got on the program? And he said, oh, we've got this and we've got that. He said, well, look, David, can you dump your main interview and we'll move it back? And of course, I've got a really good main interview for you. And he just thought I was going to offer up Tony Blair. And he said, what is it? I said, well, how would you feel if you had an exclusive interview with the first MP ever to defect straight from the Tories to Labour? And he went, orgasmic. And so he knew, The Observer knew, and kept you very quiet. But anyway, the reason I mentioned this house is that we then built around, because obviously the Tory Party conference, we built around a whole kind of media strategy. So I got my team in here about 8 o'clock at night, and I'd kept it from them. I hadn't told even the team that worked for me. It was all done very, very, very quietly. And I got them here. I'll never forget when I told them, Tim Allen, who was my number two at the time, and he said, God, he said, we were just sitting here bored for the next couple of hours waiting for The Observer to drop. And he said, this must be how terrorists feel when they know that a bomb's going to go off.
Because, of course, the Conservatives had no idea, presumably.
Absolutely none. He hadn't. One of the things, this will amuse you, one of the things that they were absolutely appalled about, he didn't even have the courtesy to tell his whip.
Well, it was amazingly shocking, because I was sort of reminded of this. He had been, you know, he was the son of a sort of stuffy major, and he'd been in the center of the Conservative Party's central office for 15 years and had been given a CBE for Mrs. Thatcher in the early 80s for his service to the Conservative Party, and had been a whip himself, I think. So it must have, he would have felt to them like a real sort of old school.
Yeah,
loyalist.
But I felt with him, and we did. Look, I said that you don't make promises. What you do say. So, for example, I remember one of the things I said was, look, we will do everything to make sure that you are welcomed into the Labour Party, that you feel welcomed. And that's what I mean about why John Prescott's reaction was so important. If John had come out and basically said, you know, we don't want these Tories, he's done all this damage, then, you know, it would have been a disaster. So actually to get John on the record saying, you know, he's doing it for the right reasons. He's doing it because he believes in tackling child poverty.
You'll remember he was a massive Brexiteer and came out for Brexit during the Brexit.
Look, that was after my time, Rory. I'm just talking about then. Okay. No, so that went really, really well. And then, of course, Sean Woodward, he was quite important within the Conservative firmament because, of course, he'd been a party strategist for a long time.
Am I right in saying he was incredibly wealthy? He was married to a Sainsbury heiress?
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, very, very wealthy. Obviously, anything that is not the first, it gets maybe less attention, but that was still seen as a very, very big blow.
So Woodward was after you were in office, and Alan Howarth was when you were campaigning.
Correct. The one in opposition, it really felt like a sort of massive hit on the Conservative Party morale. Now, I think partly because the media now moves on so quickly from things. I don't know if the Dan Poulter thing has had quite that impact upon the Conservatives. I mean, Sunak's interview on Trevor Phillips' programme was pre-recorded, so it was before this happened. But I didn't sort of feel within the studio that day that, oh, they're all obsessing about this Dan Poulter thing. Whereas on the day of the Alan Howarth defection, I mean, I can remember getting a phone call from some of the journalists at the party conference. And I can't remember who it was, but one of them phoned me up and he said, God, if you were here now, they literally would lynch you, because all they're talking about is how you have utterly destroyed their conference.
It's interesting how things have changed. I was reading some of the comments they made about Sean Woodward, and maybe this is a bit unfair to read it now because he may be a friend of yours. I don't really know him, but, you know, William Hague wrote a letter saying, you've left a party whose members have given you their loyal support. You've done so for reasons not of integrity or of principle, for your own careerist reasons. And Chris Mullin wrote with shock of the awful Sean Woodward. defecting to Mullen's side. One of New Labour's vilest stitch-ups made my flesh creep. That was one of your own MPs.
Was that in his diaries or at the time? He didn't say that at the time, did he?
That's in his diaries. He published it in his diaries.
I'm sure Chris wouldn't have. Chris was a loyal foot soldier. He wouldn't have said that at the time. No, but that's what happens. It happened a bit with Dan Poulter, didn't it? Because you had some Labour people saying, why are we having this guy who voted for this? Why has it taken so long? And then you had Tories saying, this is absolute disloyalty and terrible for his constituents and there should be a by-election. Or frankly, I don't care how big the majority is. I don't think they really want a by-election. But no, defections, I really enjoyed defections. I really did. And I remember thinking, I'd love to have been a spy exchange operator during the Cold War. I really would have enjoyed that. And it did feel a little bit like that because you were doing something that you knew could go wrong. You knew they could get cold feet. You knew that you had to be very, very, very careful about the actual facts of what was happening. And I'll tell you the clincher with Alan Howarth. I remember this. This just popped into my head now. I remember him saying the thing he was most worried about was his family and what they would think. And I can remember him when he phoned and said to me that he just told his daughter and she said it was the best thing he'd ever done. And I could feel the relief that because he had been, Margaret Hodge used the word agonizing. He had been absolutely agonizing.
Yeah. Well, it must be awful because, even becoming an independent and leaving the Tory party, obviously I've made a lot of my colleagues very angry and disappointed. Mm. And it's a very kind of tribal loyalist game. And it must feel very difficult for these people when they defect. And of course, everybody then has an incentive to portray you in the worst possible light.
Do you think there'll be any more?
Yeah, I think there could be one or two more. Yeah, I think watch this space. But they'll, of course, be watching how Dan Poulter's departure's seen. And I just counsel colleagues leaving to be ready for the way that, you do it because you believe in it, but you have to be realistic about the fact that your former colleagues are going to put the worst possible spin on it. They'll never believe you did it for principle. They'll always believe, particularly when your party's about to be wiped out in an election and they're 20 points ahead, that you're just jumping off a sinking ship.
Yeah. Well, as our listeners know, I'm not a member of the Labour Party, but are there any Conservative MPs there who want to defect before the next election and they want a trusted, experienced defection handler? I'm here for you all. shall we take a break?
Yeah. Yep. Okay, let's take a break.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night, ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga, Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Welcome back to The Rest is Politics with me, Rory Stewart.
And me, Alistair Campbell.
So I'm still trying to get my head around you as the defection agent. I've got an idea that what one could do is run somebody pretending to Labour that they were going to defect, get them all really excited and then humiliate them at the last moment.
Do you seriously think I would fall for that? Do you seriously think that if Steve Baker came along and said, I'm thinking of defecting to the Labour Party, Alistair, could I come and have a chat to you about it? Fuck off.
Right. Maybe no. I've ruined my ruse. Yeah.
So
funny.
There was just for podcast listeners, that voice that said, what's so funny around the corner was my son, Sasha, popping his head around to.
Last year, Rory, according to the latest report analysing all defence spending in the world, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, which I think is the latest, $2.4 trillion spent on defence. That's 2.3% of global GDP, pretty much allied to the rate of inflation in terms of the rise. But I think what you are seeing is some pretty big changes happening in the defense spending world. So the US is the biggest spender by a long, 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 long way, $916 billion. That's 37% of all the money that's spent on defense. China's second with almost $300 billion. Russia is third with just over 100. Then it's India. Then it's Saudi. Then it's the UK. But we're very low when it comes to both size as military. We're very, very low. And we're also low. We're about 50th when it comes to share of GDP. No surprises for guessing what's number one. That's Ukraine, 37. And it's interesting to see the ones that are spending the most because it sort of reflects kind of where a lot of trouble spots are. Algeria's next, then Saudi, then Russia, then Oman, then Israel, then Kuwait, then Poland. Interestingly, Poland has had the biggest increase in spending within Europe. Then the US, then Greece, then Colombia. That's because of Turkey, partly. Then Colombia, then South Korea, Pakistan, Singapore, Finland. In terms of the size of personnel, we now have the smallest army that we've had since the time of Napoleon. And compared with China, 2.2 million military personnel, India, 1.5, USA, almost the same, North Korea, 1.3, Russia, 1 million. And in Europe, Turkey's the biggest, followed by Ukraine, followed by France, followed by Germany, followed by us in 34th place in the world. So our military is shrinking.
It's very interesting, isn't it? And it's coming, of course. One of the reasons that we're talking about this is that Rishi Sunak has just announced that he's going to be increasing defense spending to 2.5% of GDP. And the figure that's come out of the MOD is that we're going to be spending another £75 billion over the next 5 years on defense.
Which is utterly dishonest, as I shall explain.
And is utterly dishonest. And actually, the theme of dishonesty runs through an enormous number of our defense budgets and defense conversations over many, many years. Mm. There's a guy called Francis Chuser who is really, really good on this and frequently points out, just a couple of points that resonate with what you were saying. He would say, listen, Britain is always boosting itself and talking about how great it is, but actually Poland at the moment is able to deploy two armored divisions of nearly 18,000 soldiers. And Britain really struggles, really, really struggles to keep much more than a brigade on the ground at the moment. And there's a lot of obfuscating around this. And he also says that these numbers are a bit odd. I think you can develop this a bit more, but we're always sticking in things like pensions and Ukraine funding and intelligence accounts, which other people don't stick into their calculations to drive up our defense budget. Anyway, over to you on dishonest figures.
Well, I'll tell you what it is. So they came out. And first of all, to remember, we've had several budgets, autumn statements, etc. If you're going to do something as big as this, right, say we're going to have this massive increase in defense spending, you'd have thought there might have been a hint of it in one of those. So it looks to me like yet another thing that they're just coming along to say. Now, as it happens, I support it.
And how did he do it? Was there a big press conference? Did he get a lot of mileage for it? Did it work for him? Was this the right way? If you're going to do it, if you're going to announce £75 billion, presumably you want to get a lot of positive coverage for it. Did he manage to succeed?
He got a lot of coverage. They briefed it. They got a lot of coverage overnight in the papers. I think he did a visit somewhere. I can't remember now. Laura Trott, the chief secretary, did a visit. She was the one who trotted out this £75 billion lie, which I'll explain in a minute. It's interesting. I can't actually remember. But yes, it got a lot of coverage. Yes, it did. But the fact that he didn't do it in Parliament says to, or in a budget statement or an autumn statement says to me that it wasn't serious. The reason why this $75 billion is a complete lie. Oh, and by the way, Rory, the Tories have announced that they're going to get to 2.5% several times in recent years. And I'd also remind them that when we were in power, it was 2.5%. I'm not saying that, defence spending has fallen pretty steadily since the Cold War, but it was 2.5% when we were there. But the reason it's not credible is, well, lots of reasons. The first is that they say they're going to pay for it by sacking 70,000 civil servants. I mean, that's utterly absurd. It wouldn't get you the savings, added to which it's just back of a fag packet stuff. But the entire basis of $75 billion is that over the next 6 years, they're starting from a zero growth baseline. In other words, they're removing the spending that they've already announced is going to grow and coming from zero so that every addition over those 6 years comes to $60 billion. So what I've noticed about Rishi Sunak is that virtually everything he says at the moment is being commented, check comment on social media. Full facts say this. This figure is misleading. It assumes spending would otherwise have been frozen in cash terms and fallen as a percentage of GDP over the next 6 years, which, by the way, would have been a breach of our NATO obligations. If you assume spending would otherwise have been maintained as a percentage of GDP, the increase is around $20 billion. Now, given this was such a big thing anyway, why do they feel the need to lie like that? I just don't understand it.
Well, there's a long tradition of lying. So a lot of it is that when the government's not lying, and I agree the government this moment's lying, the military themselves are endlessly lying and misrepresenting the situation. I mean, there's an incredibly weird boosterism and misrepresentation in the way the British military fight.
But Rory, just on that, the military I speak to, they certainly in private, they're doing the opposite. They're saying we're in deep shit.
But you should see the testimonies that they give to committees. You should see the criticisms that the National Audit Office has made year after year over 10 years.
Yeah, that's true.
It's astonishing. I mean, the NAO basically couldn't be more blatant. They say, basically, we can't trust a word we hear from the service chiefs of the military.
I mean, I support both Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer have now said that they want to get defence spending to 2.5% of GDP. I support that. I think we are going to have to do a lot more to defend ourselves. But the first thing to say is they have been cutting defence. If they'd stuck to the sort of plans that we were on, the defence would have had an additional 80 billion in the time that they've been there. And also, don't forget, he did cut it when he was Chancellor. But I just can't get why they feel they have to. It's back to this Johnson sort of world-beating, you call it boosterism. But when it's something as serious as this, I really, really hope that during the general election campaign, Keir Starmer, David Lammy, John Healey, the Shadow Defence Secretary, I hope that they make foreign policy and defence a big part of the campaign. Because what we've lost since the sort of Thatcher, Kinnock, Major Blair era, I think, has been an understanding that part of the role of politicians is actually to educate people about the realities of the world, explain why the world is genuinely more dangerous. But if you're going to get caught on something like this, and reading the reactions to Sunak's speech, you mentioned Francis Tooser. Is he still with RUSI?
He's not with RUSI, but he writes for them occasionally. Yeah.
The Royal United Services Institute, their Deputy Director General, Malcolm Chambers, his reaction to this is it's very unclear how this is going to be delivered. There was a guy, Nick Carter, who used to be the head of the British Army. He was at a select committee this week, and he said he doubted very much that this new money could sort out the modernisation issues that the British Army is facing.
And this is basically, to go back to the sort of fundamental problem, the military is in a permanent black hole. I mean, their finances are in a permanent black hole.
Partly because of procurement.
And a lot of it to do with procurement. So they're spending, you know, often 40-45% of their money on buying kit. And there's a procurement in the British military has been a huge problem. If people who want to interested, there's a very good recent House of Commons Defence Select Committee report on procurement. But it's basically repeating a story that we've heard for 20 years. Which is we're really, really bad at procuring stuff. Francis Tooser's got a good comparison with the French, where their procurement organization is a very highly motivated organization of engineers. They're civilians, but they have their own uniforms. They seem to do a much, much better job at buying kit than we do. And we've talked about procurement and where it all goes wrong. But the result is that we end up with such a black hole through over-optimism and miscalculating by billions of pounds every year.
Yeah.
How much this stuff is really going to cost, that producing, even if they produce an extra 20, 25 billion over 5 years, which is an extra £4 billion a year, is not nothing. As Nick Carter says, it doesn't begin to address the problem. And the problems, you know, run through some of these problems. One problem is the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, instead of cooperating, operate as three warring tribes, and all they want to do is make sure all the money goes to them and doesn't go to the others. The Navy and the Air Force particularly love big kit. So the Navy got completely obsessed with getting these big aircraft carriers. Gordon Brown set off down that path of building these big aircraft carriers, and it turns out that we can't afford to actually keep planes on these aircraft carriers properly. Can't afford enough F-35s, and those that we have, we're not maintaining or keeping the pilot hours up to actually be able to fly enough of them off them. We don't have the carrier battle fleet to surround them, so we can't really protect them. And it's pretty clear that technology is changing so much that these are just enormous floating targets. So we're investing billions in these things, which are just sort of show-off prestige items, which are not a sensible investment for the British military.
Meanwhile, what we saw in the Iran-Israel stuff recently is that you're getting $100 million planes that are having to go up and take out $55,000 drones. And Russia, obviously a lot of this, the reason we're having this conversation, a lot of it to do with Russia, the reason why Poland has become the biggest, as I said, almost 4% of GDP now. And their foreign minister said at the weekend that the world is facing a choice. You've either got Russian troops pushed out of Ukraine, or you've got Russian troops at the border of Poland. So that's why we're talking about this. And on the defense procurement, though, I mean, somebody sent me this note on this, that these armored vehicles, Ajax armored vehicles, they've spent £4 billion so far. They haven't received a single deployed vehicle, and they won't be fully in service until the next decade. That's £4 billion.
And that's before you look at the incredible gaps between how many tanks we claim to have, how many tanks we have available, and how many tanks are actually operational. So we'll claim that we have, I don't know, 237 Challenger tanks. Then the MOD will admit that they have 157 operational Challenger tanks. And then it will turn out that actually 59 or 60 of them are actually able to operate at all, are fit to go on exercise, let alone go to war.
Just saying, China have 6,457.
Right. Part of this is decisions. So we really ran down the number of tanks, partly because David Richards, who was the head of the military, was on record saying that he didn't think that we were going to have to go and do land wars in Europe anymore. I remember this when I was House of Commons Defence Committee. I was the chair of the Defence Committee for a year.
That great war leader, Boris Johnson, said the same.
Right. The story at the time was it was all going to be stuff like Afghanistan, which is small unit operations, counterinsurgency against enemies like the Taliban, and we're not going to have to worry about things like fighting the Russians anymore. The plane story. So we bought over 30 of these incredibly expensive American planes, these F-35Bs. Of the 30 that I think we got 33 of them. How many do you think we actually managed to fly at the moment?
Oh, God, and we're in six.
Yeah, eight. You're basically there. And why is it? It turns out we don't have the spare parts. We're not doing the maintenance properly. We don't have enough money for the pilots to fly. We don't have enough pilots. And those two things are related. Well, you know, pilots are leaving the Air Force because they're just not getting enough hours flying the planes. And they're not getting enough hours flying planes because we don't have the budget to pay for them to go up as much as they want to go up. I mean, the whole thing is really weird. And one of the problems with the extra $20 billion is they'll probably spend, you know, they'll spend $10 billion maybe on equipment for the Ukraine. The other $10 billion, instead of sorting out these kind of underlying issues of recruitment and training and getting their existing kit operational, the service chiefs will be tempted to buy even more unaffordable kit without thinking about the maintenance and the manpower.
Yeah. I've done some work in the past on military housing, which is terrible. You know, we are forcing forces and their families to live in absolutely awful accommodation. So morale is very low. The last satisfaction, this stuff gets surveys get done. Satisfaction with service life in 2010 was 60%. It's now around 40%. They've missed every single recruitment target. So that there's going to have to be a fundamental review of all this. And just on the numbers, Rory, there's a fascinating debate going on in Germany at the moment, because there are two. I'm going to teach you a little bit of German, Rory.
Yes.
Wehrpflicht.
Yes.
And Kriegstüchtig.
Kriegstüchtig.
Kriegstüchtig. You know what Krieg is, don't you?
Kriegstüchtig. Yeah, that's Blitzkrieg. Yeah.
Yeah, well, Kriegstüchtig means war ready.
Yeah.
Wehrpflicht means compulsory military service. So then, having a debate, the defense minister, Boris Pistorius, has announced that in mid-May, he's going to be setting out the terms of a debate about what Wehrpflicht might look like. So you're talking about, now Germany is one of the, for all the talk of, you know, Zeitenwende, change in time and all that, at the start of Ukraine, they're one of the, you know, they're not as hawkish on defense as, for obvious reasons, as maybe France and the UK and certainly the US. But they are, Pistorius, he said, democracy cannot defend itself. And he basically is saying that they're falling backwards in terms of equipment and of numbers, and they may have to bring in military service. And there's a lot of talk about this Swedish model, which Sweden has a sort of partial conscription for both men and women, has had since 2017.
And the Swedish model, I believe you volunteer. No, sorry, you're conscripted, but they select the people who they think are best.
Right? Yeah, and I think there is also option that you don't necessarily have to be in a potential fighting role. You can do all sorts of other things, but you can go in the civil defense organizations. But the point is that I'm just not sure that people in our countries are quite aware of how quickly this debate is developing. Because the truth is, we're not, as when you go through the countries that are really investing in defense, you know, we have fallen behind. I mean, the reason
to invest, obviously, sorry, to state the obvious, is not to go to war. The reason to invest is to deter. It's to make sure that people like Putin do not feel, and particularly given that he's making progress at the moment in Ukraine, he's broken through an Avdiivka and is likely to make more progress this year, that he doesn't begin to think the rest of Europe is a kind of soft target.
And of course, where Donald Trump, I very rarely say where Donald Trump has a point, but the truth is that Europe has basically assume that America is going to be there forever. And it's not necessarily the case. And of course, within the European defense, I mean, you've got Macron. Macron made an extraordinary speech last week, by the way, at the Sorbonne. But he's also, part of one of the things he's been saying, he's been sort of floating this idea that France's nuclear protection should maybe cover other European countries as well. And of course, that's not going down terribly well with some places.
The French nuclear umbrella.
Exactly. So look, I think this is something that we should come back to fairly regularly, because I think there's so much happening in different parts of the world on not just on defence spending, but on defence thinking, on strategic thinking, which I just don't think the public really, even though they're watching what's happening in Ukraine, they're watching what's happening in Israel, Gaza, they know that China, Taiwan is a kind of, you know, a big thing bubbling away in the background. But are we really ready as a country for the debate that some of our leaders are starting to say we're going to have?
And I think also being realistic about our limits. I mean, being realistic about the fact that it feels like the British Army and the Patrick Sanders, who just stepped down as the head of the army, said it feels like the military in sort of 1937, or, you know, knackered equipment, exhausted troops, no proper training. I mean, it's really embarrassing. I mean, I talked about the Air Force. You know, we could have a similar conversation about your Navy ships, you know, ships tied up, not really going to sea, totally knackered, kind of forgotten about, being unable to man them. I mean, there's something really badly wrong. And at the same time, we have this weird pretentiousness where we write defense reviews pretending that we're going to tilt towards Asia Pacific and we're going to be kind of that sending one patrol ship to sort of potter around off the coast of Japan is going to make the slightest difference to anybody.
Mm. I think the thing I've been most disappointed in Sunak about is the fact that actually, far from reversing this sort of exaggerating, boostering, bullshitting, global Britanning, world beating nonsense that Johnson became identified with, he's trying to do the same thing. It just doesn't, people have seen through it, and I think they're sick of it.
It's so distressing, isn't it? Just to finish though, I mean, I remember in politics how boring it was that they were endlessly re-announcing the same thing all the time. I mean, I secured a commitment to, I think, the duelling of the A66 in my constituency in a budget in about 2011. Well, the government then succeeded in re-announcing the duelling of the A66 every year since, including my successor managed to get a fantastic press release in 2024.
And has it yet happened?
Of course not. It's not going to be duelled till about 2030, 2035.
That could be a fourth term Labour government job, that one, Rory.
Yeah, exactly. Well, of course, actually, there'll be a fantastic announcement from the new Labour government, same thing. Okay, now, really exciting news, though. We have almost sold out all our shows, but we do still have tickets for some of our tours, not sadly for Brighton and Glasgow, which are completely sold out. But if you're in Manchester, almost all gone, very low ticket warning, but there's still a couple left for Manchester. And there are opportunities in Cardiff and Birmingham. So this is our October tour. And over to you on London, Alistair.
Well, the O2, I mean, I actually couldn't quite believe that we were doing the O2, and we are on track to sell it out because it's still going in the right direction. But you can. That's the biggest venue that we're going to do, and there are still tickets there as well.
Excellent. Well, looking forward to it very, very much. That's our October pre-election tour. Everything that you need to know about politics and a bit of bagpipes on the side.
All right, Rory. See you soon.
All right. See you soon. Thanks.